Airway presentation to follow Suzanne Brown's Airway PowerPoint from the 4th Annual Smoky Mountain Nursing Conference in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, 2009.
I think the biggest thing in conscious sedation when we are doing that and airway management is literally the number one thing is an awareness. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk a little bit about the basics of anatomy, and we're only very briefly going to talk about some of the equipment. But I think awareness is the number one thing, and I have to say, if I were totally and completely honest, as a nurse anesthetist, I have periodically gotten distracted a little bit in the operating room, and that sometimes will happen when I think I have a patient that everything is all nice and stable on, and we're having a great conversation either about politics or a sport or a particular issue that I'm interested in, and I get to chatting with my colleagues in the room. So even I have a little bit of a trouble with sometimes making absolutely sure that I'm aware and paying close attention. So the first thing we want to do when we're looking at airway management, and this is principally, again, for the conscious sedation situations, is we want to assess the potential problems. And there's a few that we can all identify with. We understand that this is a patient that we are very likely to have airway issues with. And so everybody in the room gets it. And everybody in the room is paying attention. This one also is a patient that even the most unattuned person in the operating room will often recognize that, golly, this might be a little difficult patient to manage in terms of airway. So for these last two patients, they're probably not candidates, period, for conscious sedation as significant sedation. We'll talk a little bit about that also. You guys are very aware of the Mallampati schematic that we use. And for those of you that might not be nurse anesthetists, this is a grading system that we use to kind of grade an airway. And I think this is pretty self-explanatory for you. The next picture is maybe a little nicer in terms of what we show up there. But basically what we're doing is looking at how much can we see. And clearly in this patient where we can see the entire uvula, the entire palate, clear back into the tonsil beds, this should be an easy intubation. Moving down the scale to this one where when they open their mouth, we can see the roof of their mouth, and that's about it. Now, for any of you that are maybe young anesthetist or not anesthetist, this works really well 98% of the time. But I've gotten fooled. I've had an airway that looked like this, and I had trouble intubating them. I've had probably more on this side. I've had airways that looked like this. I've had everything and everybody in the room and put it in the first drop of a hat and kind of look around and say, it's harder than I thought. I know it was harder than I thought. So it's not clear. And there's several other things we use, thiomental distance and flexibility, but all of us who've really done this a long time know that you're never 100% with any of these. But it's really pretty good. And it gives us a really clear indication of what patients might be at risk for airway problems. I like this slide because I simply like the anatomy so that you can kind of begin to see how everything fits together. And there's the, whoops, there's the wrong. How did I do that? There we go. And that this is obviously the issue that we're trying to keep open right here, and that's the tongue, which falls back and, of course, is a major point of obstruction for the airflow, whether it comes either nasally or orally. But at any rate, it's a nice little anatomy review. And some of the upper airway anatomy functions might be at least useful for us to review, and that is that they do warm, filter and humidify that air, and especially the turbinates. And it really does make a difference. Because when we put cold, unhumidified oxygen air on these people, that actually overburdens the system, and so they have problems with keeping that done. The nasal cavity and the nasal pharynx are formed by the unions of the facial bones. And I know this is something that everybody knows, but just a reminder, remember that the nasal floor is down towards the ear, not up towards the eye. We think about sticking things up our nose, but actually the floor of the nasal cavity goes downward. They are delicate vascular tissues. I'm sure all of us are aware of that. We've put in nasal tubes at some point in time and managed to get a rip-roaring wonderful nosebleed. The adenoids, which are gone in most adults or shrunken in most adults, if not removed, certainly are of the lymph system, and they do filter bacteria, and they're commonly infected. The oral cavity and the oral pharynx, we have the tonsils, again, additional lymph tissue, which can be infected, sometimes at a low-grade level, but a lot of us do carry that infection around. The epiglottis, that old leaf-like structure, closes during swallowing. The idea is to prevent that aspiration that we're also worried about. And then the follicula, which is really a pocket. It's not an item. It's a pocket that is formed at the base of the tongue and at the epiglottis, and it's one of those landmarks that we're all using when we try to intubate patients. And in the oral cavity and the oral pharynx, there's, of course, the teeth, which may be permanent or may be removable. One comment I would like to make about teeth, and I'm sure that most of you already know that, and that is if people have both upper and lower dentures and we're going to be doing conscious sedation, I prefer those teeth to be in. And the reason I do is it keeps that mouth structure in the state that it normally is, and it's much easier for those people to maintain their airway. If you take the teeth out, then they tend to have a little floppier cavity. Then, of course, there's always the exceptional patient in which the minute they kind of get a little sleepy, they don't happen to use maybe enough glue on their teeth, and the minute they do, the teeth are just floating bodies. So if they're floating foreign bodies in the mouth, then I do take them out. But most people these days who have dentures fix them in place, and they generally fit well, and in those cases we prefer to leave them in. Occasionally still work in a place where the nurses are very good, but they're a little aggressive, and periodically they'll already have everybody's teeth out when they come through the doors, whether they need to or not. So I've been known to go get them and put them back in. Tongue, well, it's attached at the mandible, the hyoid bone, and it is the most common airway obstruction. And I think pretty much most of us know that. Again, most of this talk is not about what you don't know. It's just kind of a review, and maybe for the few nurses in here who don't do this on a routine basis can help them a little bit. The palate is forming at the roof of the mouth between the nasal cavity. It separates the oral pharynx and the nasopharynx. And in the anterior part is the hard palate, and the posterior part is the soft palate. And that's the part that flops around a lot and can... right back in here, and then there's the uvula that comes down. Some folks that have had this palato surgery for snoring will have that removed. So if you look back in there and you don't find it, you've probably had it taken out. So hopefully they won't snore so bad. However, the tongue can still obstruct, but this causes a lot of the noise. Tonsil beds, teeth, pretty routine. So in the upper airway anatomy, we have the larynx, which is attached to the hyoid bone. It's kind of a horseshoe-shaped bone, supports the trachea. And then you have the thyroid cartilage, which goes across. And it is the largest laryngeal cartilage, meaning it's the bigger one. It's kind of shield-shaped. It forms the Adam's apple. And then the glottic opening is right behind that. And in the larynx, it has a glottic opening, which is the adult airway's narrowest point. So if something doesn't want to go through that, we don't want to shove it. Now, of course, in pediatrics, we know, and although this isn't specifically for that, the smallest point is the next cricoid ring. So sometimes a tube will go through the glottic opening, but will not go through beyond that. So you have to be careful. The glottic opening is dependent on muscle tone. That's why we give a lot of muscle relaxant. Although these days, I think that more and more of us, at least in my institution, are moving away from additional muscle relaxant and just giving a little extra propofol and intubating most of our patients without muscle relaxant unless we're going to need it for the duration of the case. And the larynx obviously contains those vocal bands or vocal cords, which can have lots of polyps on them or other things. The arytenoid cartilage is that posterior attachment of the vocal cords, in essence. Did I have a duplicate? Oh, I think I did. So the larynx and the trachea are those associated structures that go with that. You have the thyroid gland, which sometimes can be quite large, and actually I've run into lots of goiters in third world countries where the goiter comes out much further than the chin does. Those are always interesting. But they don't, sometimes they have them dealt with. One of the gentlemen that I showed you from Cambodia, Bun Ram, his mother has one of the most more impressive goiters I've ever seen, but she never had it operated on and doesn't intend to. Doesn't bother her. She seems to be fine. It kind of sticks out a little bit, but she's gotten used to it, and everybody around her has, so she keeps it. But the thyroid gland certainly can be enlarged, although truly in this country we rarely see that. But it is below the cricoid cartilage, lies across the trachea, and then kind of comes up both sides. So that's why when it gets big, it's usually bilateral on both sides. And then, of course, we all know that the carotid arteries branch across and kind of alongside the trachea and the jugular veins as well. A little look at the upper airway anatomy. Any of you that have any allergies or allergic rhinitis know exactly where these spots are because they're the ones that hurt when you get a little bit infected. But these are the cavities that are formed by the sinus bones. And in most of us, they are hollow, and it's a tributary for the fluid to go from one spot to another, either from the eustachian tubes or the tear ducts and all that kind of through. They certainly can and do trap bacteria. They can become significantly clogged with polyps and or other fluid. So sometimes these patients can have a lot of trouble if we're going to do conscious sedation on them if they have lots and lots of nasal drainage because they don't lay flat very well and now that drainage goes back there and becomes very irritating and it becomes a real source of them coughing and spasming and that kind of stuff. But most of the time we get by with it. Another nice look, again, more for folks who don't see it on a routine basis as we do, as the vocal folds, here they are. The trachea is this area back behind. Here's this epiglottis, that leaf-like structure, and that's the base of the tongue. So the patient would be laying down, and we're actually lifting up looking that way. And that's the ideal view that we get through the laryngoscope. Another slight look at the upper airway anatomy, just so that you can kind of get a basis for where everything is. So when we talk about airway management in conscious sedation, number one is to really assess those potential problems. And I already showed you a couple of pictures of that, but I want to go back to that because it truly is important. There have been a few patients over my career that I have refused to do conscious sedation on based upon their airway. Now, they're not huge numbers, but they are just a few people. The other ones that I think are a little more difficult are these folks to assess the potential problems on. That is the sleep apneic patient. How sleep apneic are they? How dependent are they on are they using a CPAP at home, and how dependent are they on it? We have some folks that are extremely dependent, as you all know, and by golly, they'll hardly even take a nap without it. And you know, in those folks, if that's their history of sleep apnea, that when you give them a little sedation, and in particular, if you add a little bit of narcotic to that sedation, they're going to need some help with their airway. They need help with their airway. So there's a couple of things that you might want to think about. Lightening their sedation would be one. Certainly, is this a kind of a procedure that we can keep their back elevated? If we're doing podiatry work on their toe, there's no reason we couldn't set them up with some significant angle so that they can get some of that head up thing. And then the other ones are people that have asthma and URIs. And those, I think, really have to be a clinical judgment thing. You have to figure out how bad is that patient. We've all done the bad asthmatic who does just beautifully fine. There is no issue. They puff on their inhaler before they go in. You give them a little sedation and no problem. Then there have been times where we've had an asthmatic who is not necessarily doing particularly well that day. You take them in, you give them a little sedation, and they don't do particularly well. So I think you have to listen to the patient. How are they today is one of my favorite questions that I ask them, because patients are not dumb, most of them. They do know. How are they today? Listen to them. Look at their history. And a lot of these patients can easily have that. And then there's the URIs. And we have had an occasional patient in our institution that has really had a bad URI, comes in, is really in the thick of that, and they still come in anyway. And we have really backed off on doing it because they're coughing and spurting and, you know, that kind of thing. But most people with URIs, if it is past the stage where they can breathe through their nose or, you know, they're kind of over it, in a general rule, I think you can, with some care, do conscious sedation on these folks. But it has to, I think, be a little bit of an individual call. Look at the patient. Look at what you're doing. Are you operating on some area like their ear? For example, maybe we're doing just a little cosmetic thing in their ear and they're going to be all covered up and you can't get to them. Are you operating on their toe where you have full access and you can set them up and you can really determine what's going on? So I really think those have to be individually called. Again, kind of going back to the idea of maybe nurses that don't routinely do sedation, I kind of came up with this kind of a quick clinical airway assessment for nurses. We aren't going to do the full Mallampati, fiddle the breasts and all that kind of thing. But if patients have a really small mouth opening, if they have a significant recessive chin, now the lady in the picture was maybe a little dramatic, but there are a lot of people that have recessive chins. That aren't maybe quite that dramatic. Then there's the other one that I think that is Miss No Neck or Mr. No Neck, that can be both, where you really can't find their neck. We have a few guys who come in, and sometimes they've been football players, you know, and they have these massive shoulders that come up to their ears. I mean, they're not obese or anything, but I mean, they just don't have any neck. It's just, you know, one piece here. And they have a little bit of movement, thank heavens. But sometimes those folks have such airway issues that maybe they're not a good idea. And then the last one is, and this one's not negotiable for me, and that's too much hardware. By hardware, I mean, you know, the balls on the tongue, the things in their mouth. You know, Bonnie said I live on the West Coast, and there's a lot of body-piercing places out there. And I have occasionally had patients come in with so much hardware, literally, around their mouth, that I was concerned that I could get a laryngoscope in if I needed it, concerned certainly that I could get anything in, and tongue studs for me come out. I don't talk about it. The tongue stud doesn't come out, we're done. There is no sedation. And certainly we are all aware that there have been issues where tongue studs have gotten loose and gotten down into the trachea and then had to have a bronchoscopy to get the piece out. So it doesn't work. The issue for me, or at least that I encounter a lot with resistance to taking the tongue stud out, is they're afraid it will close up. So for those people that have that concern, I simply go get a piece of silk suture, because we use silk suture on lungs all the time, and have them tie it to the end of the tongue stud and thread it through, and then loop it out at the back. So they've got a big loop of thread coming out, but it keeps that hole open. And I've had people who were not initially happy about taking their tongue stud out who then will be happy to do that. So tongue studs need to come out, and any peripheral around the lip hardware. I don't know if you guys have those here, but I mean, I literally have seen people that have rings all around their lip, several of them, and they need to come out. And so if the airway is at risk, and again, kind of designed for people that maybe don't do this all the time, if you're a nurse that's going to do conscious sedation and you think that the airway may be at risk, this may be a case to defer to anesthesia. Let them come in. Let them evaluate it. Let them see what they think about it. Certainly some of the things that certainly one of my choices would be very light sedation. and I mean really light sedation and heavy tincture of talc. This is the patient in which you can often, with just a little bit of sedation and a whole lot of the techniques that Ronnie's been teaching earlier this week, you can talk people into lots of things. If you bring them along and tell them, and you're going to be there, lots of touch, lots of talking, and a lot of times we can get people through things on a lot less sedation if we just do that. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the hour. But again, these are, if I have an airway that I'm not happy with, then that's the discussion that I have with the surgeon. I'm not willing to do the, you know, sometimes surgeon's idea of conscious sedation is room air general. And these are not the patients that would qualify for that kind of a sedation. So it's very light sedation and a whole bunch of the tincture of talc. And it's amazing what you can do with that. One clinical pearl that I would remind all of us of, and I am periodically reminded of it myself, and that is that if the O2 sat monitor or the monitor changes or delay, you have the apnea, and then it's several seconds, about 30 seconds later, before the sedation goes down. I mean, the saturation goes down. Remember that. And then likewise, if they're finally taking a deep breath and you know that they're fine and you know that they're responding, your O2 sat's still low, everybody else in the room is getting excited, and you know that you're fine, again, there's that same delay. But the piece of it that I think is important is that on the awareness side, it's really a good idea if we can maintain such an awareness either by watching, observing, and talking to our patient or by having a precordial stethoscope on so that we know that the apnea is happening before the O2 sat monitor tells us. It gives you a whole lot of room to maneuver. And then, of course, there's all of the kinds of things that we can do in terms of airway reminders when we're doing patients under sedation. And that's just the verbal things. Take a deep breath. We've all done this. Okay, Johnny. Susie, take a deep breath. Very, very often these patients will respond to you and do exactly what you want. The other one is how many times we kind of do a jaw tug, a little bit of a tug, then they'll take a deep breath. We've all repositioned their head. Those of us that have spouses that we sleep with will occasionally reposition the head in the middle of the night. You know, you gotta do what you can. And then often touching a shoulder, rubbing or stroking a cheek will encourage people to take that other deep breath. This picture is the picture that is so often printed, by the way, of how one adjusts the jaw. And what I wanted to suggest to you, notice the hand on the forehead and the way back it goes. I walk in with a lot of student nurse anesthetists and I see a lot of this. And yet, what the issue I think that we're really after is the jaw thrust. And the idea, the better way to do the jaw thrust other than pulling the patient's head way back and stressing their cervical spine is to put your fingers back here and truly thrust the jaw forward. You don't have to wrench the head back in order to get the jaw forward. And a lot of us have done that. You know, I sometimes will walk into a recovery room and I'll put fingers under the jaw and just move the jaw forward. Or the other trick that a few of us that are older that are willing to do is I'll actually sometimes put a thumb in and pull the lower teeth forward. And it does the same thing and you can get that jaw thrust forward. Again, some of the photographs showing exactly what we're doing when we're doing that, and the idea is to get that tongue up off of the back of the throat. Airways, well, obviously they're useful for obstruction. There certainly is a potential to damage for teeth. To the oral ones, there is the potential for nosebleeds with the nasal ones. There is a possibility of a laryngospasm with either one, although that's more true, I think, with the oral airways. The oral airways, you all know, or most of us know, can block the airway if it's not put in correctly, because you can actually, if you don't put the right size in, push the tongue back onto the ferrets, and you can actually make it a little worse. So oral airways, we certainly need to be the proper size. I think you guys all know about measuring from mouth to jaw, but you know, if anybody doesn't do this routinely and doesn't know that, I'll have a picture in a minute, but you really do need to measure the size of the oral airway. It does make a difference. As you can see, these two airways are significantly different in size from each other. And if someone is has a larger mouth and you put the smaller one in, the only option then as this goes in is to push against that tongue, and that pushes that tongue down into that posterior pharynx that we don't need. A 3 to 4 will work for most adults, but you know, like everything else, size matters. And you can size them. There's a couple of ways. Some people do it this way to the jaw, right here from the lips, to get your proper size, or to the tip of the ear. And in all actuality, either one will work and give you the right size. The idea is to get the oral airway to come back around the tongue so that it actually lifts it up. Again, speaking to those people who don't do this routinely, there are a couple of ways to put oral airways in. Some folks put them in essentially backwards, if you will, where you take the airway and you put it against the hard palate, and then as you get it down, you turn it around. I have to say, I don't let students do that, and I don't like that, and it may be that I have done too many palate repairs in my lifetime on kids, and I just kind of hate the idea of scraping this thing along that hard palate. So I'm much more of a proponent of open the mouth, use a tongue bite, and stick the thing in. So step one, of course, is to open it, get it ready, put it in. Nasal airways, again, pretty much, if we're talking about adults, we're talking about a 30, 32, will fit most folks. It's the same thing, though. You've got to have an airway that's long enough to get back to the back of the tongue. And remember, I think the biggest mistake that I see students make, and occasionally even see others make, is we have a tendency to stick things up a nose, and remember, the nasal floor goes down towards the ear. They're great if you're a recovery room nurse or you're someone who's giving some sedation. I think they're wonderful. They can cause nosebleeds, although most of the time, really, they don't. They're certainly easier for beginners to put in. Make sure they're lubricated well, and boy, they really do slide in. And they're less likely to cause laryngospasm. Should any of you not be familiar with putting those in, I've got some up here, and I'd be more than happy to talk to you at the break. And this is what the idea of the nasal airway is once it's in place, getting that passageway open and keeping it open. Okay. Delivery devices, there's the nasal cannula and the simple face mask, which is really pretty much all we use on conscious sedation. There are other things. There's the partial rebreathers and the Venturi mask and all of that stuff, but really the first two is about all we use in conscious sedation. The nasal cannula, the optimal delivery of 40% occurs at 6 liters per minute. However, I very rarely use that, and the reason I don't is because it just feels to the patient like you're blowing a tunnel up its nose. So somewhere around 3 or 4 usually works really well. The only problem, and it's a relative contraindication, remember if you have a patient that's a mouth breather with all their sinuses all stuffed up, you can put a nasal cannula over their lips in between their teeth. That certainly will work. But if they're a nasal breather and you're not going to do that, remember that a nasal cannula won't work very well for these folks. The simple face mask, you can get 40 to 60% at 10 liters per minute. Volumes greater than 10 liters don't increase the O2 delivery. Again, however, because of that huge blast that feels like on the patient, and that's generally dry air, I usually don't use 10. I use 5 and 6. We'll occasionally put it up. The other issue is patient comfort, and I always, as I'm sure most of you do, offer patients a choice. And sometimes, if you notice that the face mask keeps rubbing up into their nose and they're constantly pulling it down on it, rubbing up into their eyes, and they're constantly pulling it down on their nose, flip it around and put the broad part over their nose. And I've had some patients where that's much more comfortable for them. Mask and ambu, well, you know, you need to get the size to fit a mask. Make sure that it does. There is no such thing as one size fits all. The other thing is to make sure that the cuff of the mask is intact. And I've actually given this talk a lot to nurses only who do sedation. And when I do, I usually find that at some point in time, we need to really talk about the ambus, because they have limited pressure, as most of you know. So if it's a true laryngospasm, you're not going to be able to block it. But the other thing is that some of the ambus that I've seen when I've gone to these clinics are amazingly old and bad. So if you're in a situation, and I would say this even to the nurse anesthetist, because it happens to me, if you're doing conscious sedation in either an office or a remote site, go look at the ambu. Don't look at the bag to see that the ambu's hanging there. Take the thing out and look at it and find out whether or not it's decent. I don't know about anybody else, but I hate these with a passion, because I find, you have to, you know, these are the ones you have to pull out at the end so that you have a full bag. There's one of them that I pulled out one day in a clinic, and it was so old that this right here, this little ridge, the first time or two that I puffed on it, it broke, because the plastic had been in this position for so long, and it had gotten hot that when you pull that out and you actually put a little pressure on it, it just popped. So don't be so cavalier about these things. Take a look at them. This one is an example of one that I found. There's no way to put any oxygen on this at all, which may be okay, but just be aware. This does have a little handle you can put your hand through. Might be nice, might be not nice, but there you go. Again, the masks that come with these things are usually pretty deplorable. They're rigid. They're not a soft fit. Some of them are old enough that they're actually hard on this edge. I'm sorry, that one doesn't show as well. And it's like those old black masks we used to do where you can literally injure people's eyes with them. So take a look at the ambu where it is that you're at. Frequently, we get in a situation where we just think, well, there's one there. Somebody checked it, but it might have been 10 years ago. You want to make sure you don't have this thing that's really ancient. But that one is a possibility. And then, of course, I put this one up here to remind us that if you're doing pediatrics in a situation, make sure you have, in addition to your adult ambu, you actually have a pediatric ambu. And again, ambu bags, you know, you got to check for the chest rise. Just because you pump the thing in doesn't mean anything actually gets where it needs to be. And if you have the O2, make sure it's attached. I can't tell you how many times, you know, you've all done this, and there's a resuscitation going on, and you find that somebody's using an ambu, but the attachment's on the floor. You know, the O2 has become unattached. So it's one of those things. All right. Apnea occurs in conscious sedation, and I think our biggest defense is simply to be aware and really pick up on that. And you get extra brownie points if you pick up on it before the O2 sat does. Do a great assessment of your patients. You know, remember to stimulate them a little bit, because often just a little bit of stimulation will get you what you want. Position the head, open the airway. I'm sure many of you have learned this trick. A lot of times I'll use a pillow, not a donut, but a pillow, and I'll actually kind of roll the pillow so that I've got a little extra roll behind the head. And it's just like the snoring pillows that they sell, you know, you're tipping the chin a little bit. But patients find it very comfortable. If you have an apnea situation, think about the ambu. Do the stimulation. If you need to think about it, you might need to ventilate. If you need to ventilate, usually you need to think, do you need an airway? But not always. Remember, we can ventilate without airways. After a couple of breaths, reassess, because in conscious sedation, almost all the time, if you give a couple of breaths, then you're through. You don't necessarily need to do any more. And then sometimes you do. But most of the time you don't. One other little caveat is I think that a patient who has had respiratory assistance should be observed longer post-procedure period. And sometimes we see in cataract patients where we really only observe them in our institution for very few minutes. I mean, they're gone. They're out of there quickly. But if anybody who has had any airway issues, we actually make them stop and stay for 20 to 30 minutes at least, which is 4 to 5 times as long as the other ones stay. So use your judgment, be careful. But in my opinion, anybody who's had any airway assessment intervention, except for take a deep breath, Joe, but anything else, you know, where I've needed to ventilate them, then they go to an area where they can be observed in a different manner than maybe everybody else. So this talk was really as much for folks who don't necessarily do anesthesia on a full-time basis. Hopefully a little bit of review for you all. But remember, airway assistance can be managed in many ways.